Greetings. Welcome to the Columbia Care fourth quarter and full year 2018 and first quarter 2019 earnings conference call. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. A brief question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone today should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad. Please note this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the conference over to Gary Santo. Mr. Santo, you may now begin.
Thank you, operator. Actually, I will turn the call over now to our Chief Financial Officer, Lars Boesgaard.
Thanks, Gary, and thank you, Rob. Good morning, and thank you all for joining us on today's call to discuss Columbia Care's performance for the first quarter of 2019 and the fourth quarter and full year of 2018. Today's call will be led by Nicholas Vita, our CEO, and Nick is joined here by Michael Abbott, our Executive Chairman, David Hart, our Chief Operating Officer, as well as myself. You can access a replay of this call by going to the investor section on our website. Before we begin, I'd like to point out that we will be making forward-looking statements, and these statements involve certain risks and uncertainties that could cause our actual results to differ materially. Please take a look at the risk factors discussed in our SEDAR filings for additional detail. These forward-looking statements apply only as of today, and we undertake no duty to update any of the statements after the call except as required by law. I'd also like to remind you that we'll be using non-IFRS financial measures, which we believe provide useful information for the understanding of our ongoing business performance. Reconciliations of our financial results are included in our press release. These non-IFRS financial measures should be considered in addition to, but not as a substitute for, our IFRS results. Thank you. I'll now turn the call over to Nick, our CEO.
Thank you, Lars. I'm Nicholas Vita, the CEO of Columbia Care and one of the co-founders of the company. We are delighted to host our first conference call as a publicly traded company, and we look forward to sharing our results and progress with investors each quarter going forward. Today, we intend to talk about several points, most notably Q1 revenue growth, update regarding our going public transaction, our growth strategy, footprint expansion, and other financial updates from historical periods. I'll now pass on the call to David Hart, our Chief Operating Officer, who will give us some additional details about our expansion plans and progress to date.
Thanks, Nick. To date, we have implemented an aggressive infrastructure and CapEx plan for 2019. We have construction projects in every U.S. market except for two as of today. As previously communicated, we plan to have more than 50 dispensaries open by the end of 2019. We're adding a significant number of CC team members in our developing markets and expect to double the number of employees by the end of 2019 compared to year-end 2018. We're adding canopy and manufacturing throughput capabilities in our markets in anticipation of introducing our pharma quality products in every market where we have a manufacturing license. We are focused on the implementation of operational standards in all of our markets to deliver consistent patient experience and drive supply chain efficiency to enhance the long-term margin profile of the business. A few operational milestones thus far in 2019. We had our first adult use sales in Massachusetts in the first quarter. We had inspection approvals and soft openings in our Brooklyn, New York, and San Diego dispensaries, and we passed regulatory inspections for cultivation and manufacturing in Puerto Rico. And with that, I'll pass it over to Lars.
Thanks a lot, David. So I'll give everybody a quick summary of our financial results, and I'll begin by describing the key takeaways from our first quarter of 2019. We delivered a strong quarter to start the year. We reported total revenues in the first quarter of $12.9 million, which was an increase of 45% year over year, driven entirely by organic growth of our dispensary network and per-store sales as we expanded our U.S. footprint. Our gross profit before fair value adjustments was $4.4 million, an increase of 29% compared to the previous year. Gross profit, including fair value adjustments, was negative $2.2 million compared to $3.4 million in the first quarter of 2018. This decrease in gross profit was primarily due to a decrease in the volume of unharvested plants at the time of reporting. Operating expenses for the first quarter was $21.9 million, an increase of 132% compared to the previous year. The increase primarily caused by increased professional fees, salaries and benefits, as well as equity-based compensation. We did recognize expenses of approximately $4.2 million in the quarter related to our go public transaction, which was completed in April. Our adjusted EBITDA for the first quarter was a negative $10.4 million compared to a negative $2.3 million in the previous year. The lower adjusted EBITDA was primarily caused by our higher operating expenses and partially offset by higher gross profit before fair value adjustments. Reflecting the closing of the merger transaction on April 26, our March 31 pro forma cash balance was approximately $170 million. Now I'll turn to the fourth quarter and full year of 2018. Revenue for the fourth quarter of 2018 was $11 million, an increase of 36% compared to the fourth quarter of 2017. This growth was entirely organic. Gross profit before fair value adjustments was essentially unchanged at $3.9 million, as our margins were affected by entry into new markets where we're currently ramping up volume through our dispensaries and cultivation centers. Gross profit, including fair value adjustments, was a negative $0.6 million compared to a positive gross profit of $20 million in the fourth quarter of 2017. The difference was driven primarily by increased recognition of fair value of biological assets, which were included in the inventory sold during the quarter. Operating expenses in the fourth quarter of 2018 was $18.6 million compared to $10.1 million for the same quarter in 2017. The increase was primarily due to increased professional fees and salaries and benefits. Adjusted EBITDA for the fourth quarter of 2018 was a negative $7.5 million compared to negative $1.5 million for the fourth quarter of 2017. The difference was primarily due to higher operating expenses. For the full year of 2018, our revenue was $39.3 million, which was an increase of 35% compared to the full year of 2017. Gross profit before fair value adjustments in 2018 was $16.5 million, up from $13.7 million, or a 20% increase compared to 2017. Gross profit, including fair value adjustments, was $17.1 million compared to $53.7 million. The change was primarily caused by larger recognition of fair value of biological assets included in cost of revenue and inventory. Operating expenses for the full year 2018 was $50.8 million compared to $37.4 million in 2017. The increase was primarily due, again, to higher professional fees, salaries, and benefit expenses, and facilities expenses, partially offset by lower equity-based compensation expenses. Adjusted EBITDA for the full year 2018 was negative $15.6 million compared to negative $4.7 million in 2017. The decrease was primarily caused by higher operating expenses and partially offset by higher gross profit before fair value adjustments. And I'll just turn the call quickly over to Nick as we are expecting and seeing if there's any questions as well.
Thank you, Lars. Operator, do we have any? Or Gary, should we just go ahead and read the questions?
So we're waiting to see if anyone's queuing up for questions at the moment.
Okay.
If you'd like to ask a question, you may press star 1 from your telephone keypad, and a confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star 2 to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment, please, while we poll for questions. Thank you. Gentlemen, we have a question coming from the line of Bill Papanasio with Canaccord Genuity. Please proceed with your question, sir.
Hi, Bill. Hello?
Bill, your line is open for a question.
Sorry. Hey, guys. Thank you for taking my call. Just realized I was on mute. Apologize about that. I just wanted to ask you guys a couple questions. Maybe we can go state by state. So first, looking at Florida, I saw that you guys are announcing that you'll be moving into the market and rolling out 13 facilities. Perhaps you can provide some updates on that progress and any other insight.
Thanks, Bill. So the question is on a state-by-state basis, what our footprint in Florida is looking like in our expansion plans. David, do you want to – I'm sorry, Nick, you want to take it?
So I would say, obviously, Florida is one of the key markets that we're focused on, both from a strategic and tactical perspective. As we indicated in our press release, we have 13 signed leases in Florida, which I think gives visibility into where we are today as far as the market is concerned for new dispensaries. As we've said in the past, we are in the process of expanding our manufacturing and cultivation capabilities into the two locations where that's permitted. But let me turn it over to David and give you a sense of sort of how things are developing there and if there's any other insights you'd like to share.
Sure. Thanks, Nick. Yeah, as we disclosed, we've signed 13 leases. We continue to be pragmatic about finding ideal locations for a dispensary setting and making sure the commercial viability of all of the leases we're signing makes sense. Between now and the end of the year, I think we've communicated what the total dispensary count is going to be, and a large chunk of that you guys can determine that it's going to be in Florida. And so, you know, between Q2, Q3, and early Q4, we have an anticipated aggressive opening schedule for Florida, as well as a number of other new markets that are coming online.
The only other thing I would add to that, you know, I think there's an old saying, sometimes it's best to be second rather than first. And Florida is one of those interesting phenomena. And we see this throughout the country where early adopters in markets are typically locating facilities in markets where they've been able to find accommodating landlords and accommodating municipalities. What typically happens as these programs become more accepted and the adoption curve expands, and as everyone has seen, the Florida adoption curve has been quite significant, new markets begin to open up. And so if I could describe one of the things that we've been able to benefit from over the past several months, it's the fact that this program has now really become sort of a platform onto itself. The comfort level with decision makers at the municipal level has really expanded. And so there are markets where we're able to find locations that I think, you know, even a year ago might not have been available to competitors to find homes. So we're very enthusiastic about Florida because it's growing exceptionally fast, because we've been able to find the right locations in the right places, and because we found, frankly, you know, a very good labor force that will be able to help us through the sort of the manufacturing cultivation process.
Great, thanks. We think that the Florida market's going to be a big opportunity for you guys as well. Okay, so maybe moving on to New York. I saw that you guys are going to be launching a new line of industrial hemp-based CBD products. And my understanding is that you also have a hemp license in the state. And I was wondering whether you could share some more insight in terms of the strategy there in New York. And, you know, will you be building out a facility, and will it serve as a hub for your CBD operations?
So we actually have hemp licenses in more than one state, and we view hemp as a nice add-on to our existing strategy, which is to produce products that are manufactured to exacting standards that really focus on the health and wellness space. The license we have in New York, for those of you who are familiar, was identical to the license that Canopy was awarded several weeks ago that was part of a press release. We've been involved in the industrial hemp space for quite some time. We always viewed it as a smart sort of supporting tactic for our growth strategy, and we plan on leveraging the benefits of operating under not only state licenses, but the cover of now obviously the Farm Act, which will allow us to distribute the product that we manufacture into markets where that's permissible. There is a broad range of products that we manufacture and sell. We've always been known, and we're very proud of our history as being a medical company, but we also have a very concerted and focused consumer product strategy. And that consumer product strategy involves distribution channels that go well beyond the cannabis network, either our own or other operators in the medical cannabis space or even adult use space. And as a result, we're able to manufacture products that can be sold through more traditional retail channels, and we're beginning to do that actually as soon as this month. You'll see some of our products. Not all of them are going to be named Columbia Care. We have a number of different brand architectures that are designed for specific parts of the marketplace to address specific demands of specific consumers. But what they all carry with them is a consistency of quality and an expectation that it's manufactured to the exacting standards that our pharmaceutical quality products are manufactured to. So we're very excited about the uncoiling of the spring that had been waiting for the farm bill to pass. We're very excited about the new markets that and distribution channels we're able to tap into. We're very excited about the new brands and brand architectures and product formats that will come with these new brands. And we think that ultimately what we've done is over the past since 2013 is build an expertise in understanding the plant, understanding the chemistry behind the plant, the manufacturing and the packaging, and the efficiencies required to do sort of make products and distribute them effectively. And so this is part and parcel with what we've always done. I think the biggest difference is that our industrial hemp licenses allow us to grow outdoors. So it allows us to actually expand the methods of growing so we can reduce our cost of goods sold and have a much more balanced approach that doesn't rely solely on either greenhouse or indoor grows, which is typically what we do for the medical cannabis because of the requirements of the state regulations. So it has a number of very, very powerful effects that are positive.
Okay, great. And I guess just sticking on New York, this will be my last question for now, and maybe I'll jump on and give some time for some of the other analysts. Perhaps you can provide some color on how the home delivery system is growing. Do you expect to deploy it into other markets in the near future? Any kind of color you can provide on that?
Well, thank you. So what I'll do is give a very high-level overview and then turn it over to David. There are three things that I'd like to point out about the home delivery infrastructure we've developed in New York. One, it's incredibly scalable. So it allows us to really reach out and touch individual patients and institutions to sort of circumvent a traditional healthcare distribution channel and allow for more efficient, more efficient access and more basically a greater access. Two, it's not just a home delivery the way you think about someone delivering a pizza. There's a service component to it where we actually leverage our providers to help us sort of, you know, convey that personalized experience so that we can use technology platforms as access points to enhance that educational opportunity for people who are transitioning into the market from other parts of the market. And third, it's something that we've spent a lot of time optimizing, and we've seen the benefits not only from a margin perspective and an average basket size perspective, but from a patient retention perspective. And now that we've introduced additional mechanisms to facilitate transactions, electronic transactions, it's incredibly scalable for us, and it becomes a reliable automatic fulfillment opportunity that we plan on rolling out nationally. And David, I'll turn it over to you to give some of the details on how we did what we did, why we did what we did, and how we plan on scaling that, you know, for example, by using the centralized center in Brooklyn.
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, so we really focused on the service aspect of delivery in New York, and we wanted to build it to scale, and that includes automation. We, within our build-out of our Brooklyn dispensary, we did include a build-out for our headquarters for the national delivery platform with our partner, so that's been fully built out. And we do expect and anticipate to introduce home delivery in other markets where it's currently allowed with regulations, including Florida and other markets. I know that's a big topic in the Florida market as well. We also wanted to highlight the fact that we are focused on making sure that delivery is a economically viable and sustainable part of our business. And supply chain logistics around delivery is a complicated matter. And if you don't have automation and scale and the right labor structure and expectations and meeting expectations from patients, you're going to have trouble. So we wanted to perfect what we've done in New York before we rolled it out everywhere else. I think we have disclosed the fact that the basket size in New York is higher with home delivery, which I think is what we expected and hoped. It's about $100 plus more per delivery relative to our ADS in New York. And so we expect that same type of differential between home delivery and in-dispensary purchasing to replicate itself in the other markets that we roll this out to. And I do want to underscore that we've got a partner in our home delivery that has the expertise and the capabilities to make sure we can build this in a not only a scalable way, but also in an economically viable way.
I think the one thing that I would add, which is sort of unique about many of the markets we're in, obviously you have certain markets like California where home delivery is something that many people can do. But in a lot of the states we're in, because they're highly regulated, you actually have to be a licensee from the state in order to provide that home delivery service. So by, you know, for example, in New York, one of the things we wanted to do, because it's an enormous state with over 20 million people or almost 20 million people, we wanted to prove out the model and that it could be done, that home delivery could be done efficiently to all four corners of the state. And if we can do it that way in New York with the complexities of downstate New York and the five boroughs of New York City, as well as upstate where it's much more rural or suburban, then we felt comfortable that this is a platform you could actually roll out nationally into new markets and really take advantage of sort of the the interest among consumers to sort of have potentially that, let's call it that genius bar experience at one of our facilities, but then they don't necessarily need to come back to our facilities time and time again to purchase new product, especially if they're using the same thing and it works. And the reason why that's important is that when you think about what happens in markets as these regulations become less and less strict, the adoption curve increases. And so throughput at the actual facilities becomes very important. And this is one of the most sort of fundamental ways that we anticipate taking advantage of sort of, you know, let's call it border-to-border home delivery access technology, and that will allow us to focus our patient experience in the facilities on the sort of the direct experience of the consumer, you know, giving that high-touch experience without necessarily creating bottlenecks and lines.
Okay, great. Thanks for those questions. I'll hop off and allow questions from some other analysts. And thank you again, guys, for your time.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you. As a reminder, we ask you please ask one question, one follow-up. Our next, to ask a question, you may press star one. The next question is from Jason Zandberg with PI Financial. Please proceed with your questions.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Jason.
I wanted to ask a question specifically on the opioid replacement programs in the various states. I know you operate in a number of states that have this program, and I get that it's early days, but you know, it's common knowledge that there are millions of people that are on opioid prescriptions right now, and I just wanted to get your thoughts and your observations from a ground level on how the initial onboarding of these patients has been, and what are your expectations moving forward?
Well, I let me answer that in three different ways. The first, just generically, our experience with individuals looking for either a replacement to opioid therapy for pain management or as a substitute before first use of opioids has been nothing short of, you know, it's been very, very strong. We're incredibly happy with the feedback we've gotten. And to provide some context to that, we actually, you know, as many of you know on the phone, we've done, I think, a fairly good job of collecting patient data and use data with the approval of patients to understand exactly what those dynamics look like. And an analysis was conducted among neuropathy patients, excluding oncology patients, over a nine-month period. And in that analysis, what we found is that 62% of people who were given access to our precisely formulated sort of cannabis-derived medicines showed either reduction or stabilization in the use of opioids, which was a spectacular statistic that no one had ever seen before. And what we like about it is that this wasn't sort of a marijuana versus opioids comparison. It was active ingredient comparison to active ingredient because of the way we manufacture our products. That data was so spectacular that Columbia University's New York Psychiatric Institute actually took that data to NIH and applied for a grant. And in spite of the fact that we are a Schedule I substance and don't have a federal license in the United States, the NIH, through the National Institute of Drug Abuse, NIDA, actually awarded Columbia an R21 grant to expand that pilot study to validate the findings of the initial pilot that we ran, which tells you two things. One, the data was spectacular, and it was strong enough so that a federal regulator or federal entity was willing to actually sort of make a decision that could be viewed as being contradictory to federal policy to award this grant in order to facilitate the research. Number two, the NIH, as part of the grant review process, required an enormous amount of due diligence, including reviews of our products, the way they're manufactured, testing standards. All of it passed mustered with a federal agency, and obviously NIH is among the most notable research institutions in the world. So we were very proud of the fact that not only did they accept our data, they accepted our products and our methods as well. And I think that's very important for a couple of reasons, because fast forward to today and last week at SALT and the week before at Tribeca, we actually made an announcement that we're actually running could end up being one of the largest population studies in certainly cannabis, but potentially ever, where we intend to really do our best to facilitate and research the transition of people away from opioids as a, you know, as a substitute, and then providing people with access to our products as a replacement or alternative to opioids in the first place. We've called it 100 million ways to break the opioid crisis, because we plan, you know, from over a period of time, our intention is to take 100 million doses of opioids off the streets. And what's amazing is that if you look at it on a population basis, people have administered in New York State alone about over 11 million doses of our products. The only sort of side effects we've heard of, because we have an ongoing sort of review process, is occasionally people feel euphoric, occasionally people have an increase in appetite, and occasionally people sleep too much. But no one's had any sort of material adverse events the way they would under the standard of care for chronic treatment of pain. And so working with Montefiore Einstein College of Medicine, we actually have an IRB-approved study that will begin in New York and then expand from there as we roll out our pharmaceutical products nationally to combat the opioid crisis. And we've attracted an enormous amount of attention in the right way. So not only is it consistent with our mission, but it actually highlights the benefits of our products and service model, because it'll, you know, what it does is it highlights to the world that, you know, we can actually be a counterparty to an IRB and a major research institution. We can perform a national study like this, and we can actually have a profound impact potentially, you know, if everything goes the way we hope, on policy, on the standard of care, and on the way people think about sort of precisely manufactured cannabis-derived products relative to opioids.
So that's fantastic color, and I completely agree with you in terms of the effectiveness and the data on this. Just wondering, can you give any sort of indication as to how that patient onboarding has been progressing, in the early days of these programs?
So we announced the introduction of the program last week. So onboarding will happen in the next quarter or so. But just as a matter of course, when we look at the data outside of this research study, we see a fairly sizable percentage of people coming to us based on their recommendations and referrals from doctors, or based on the, sort of their own initiative to look at our products as an opioid replacement potential. And obviously, the benefit here is that as we collect the data, because we have products that can be compared to a traditional pharmaceutical product, it opens the door for a whole range of reimbursement conversations too. So when we think about sort of the knock-on effect of doing this and the way we continue to collect the data and how that data becomes sort of applicable across multiple populations, because we have similar standards for these products across multiple markets, not only does that allow us to create sort of brand recognition, but it really allows us to create validation in multiple markets, which I think has been an elusive thing for people to do, because you often have companies that have acquired assets or sort of combined companies with different strategies or different operating bases, whereas ours has been organically grown. So we really have one voice, one approach, one method of doing things.
Perfect. I appreciate the color.
Sure.
If you'd like to ask a question today, you may press star one. Thank you. At this time, I'll turn the floor back to Nick Vita for closing comments.
Great. Well, everybody, thank you very much. We're really delighted that you've been able to sort of spend some time with us this morning. And, we really appreciate your partnership, your support, your enthusiasm. We can't tell you how many times we've been getting calls and notes from folks literally all across the country expressing their enthusiasm for the type of platform we're trying to build and the purposeful mission of the organization. We will be presenting today at the Canaccord Conference in New York. We will be presenting at other conferences coming up. And to the extent that any of you have any questions, feel free to reach out to Gary directly. We'd love to hear from you. And, obviously, when you're in one of our markets, let us know, and we'd be happy to set up a tour. So thank you.
This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect your lines at this time. Thank you for your participation.